Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd in for Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Millions of Iranians are voting today to decide that country's next president. The choice comes down to the current president, Hassan Rouhani, and his challenger, Ebrahim Raisi. It's shaping up to be an election about the economy and free expression. NPR's Steve Inskeep is there. Steve, where exactly is there? Where are you?
Hi, Robin. I am in the northern part of Tehran, which is a huge megacity. It spreads over many miles and climbs up the side of the Alborz Mountains. And I'm in the cleaner air up near the top in this lovely park, watching people walking around with their families. And just down the hill from me, as we're talking, is a polling station. It's a bus, actually, and many people are lined up outside the bus to cast their ballots just at the end of the voting time. There are buses all over Tehran, as well as polling places inside mosques, which is really common.
Well, but, you know, for those, you know, maybe tuning in and thinking, what, a fair and free election in Iran? Is that really happening? Is it really
okay,
happening?
There's an election. There's an election in Iran. Is it fair and free? That is a matter of debate. I think Americans would not see it so. There is a special governmental body that restricts the number of people who can run. Hundreds, if not thousands, of people filed to run for president, and only a few are actually allowed to run in the end. The media is not nearly as free as in other places, and the most powerful institutions are essentially state-controlled. But with that said, I want to emphasize there is a choice that people have, and a choice in direction, and there is a definite debate in Iran, and you get a lot of passionate opinions from people on the street as well.
I want to hear from people on the street, but we should just say as well, it's not as if you're sitting there with a microphone waving around, because that might still be dangerous, and that's why we're speaking to you on your phone, casually here.
I mean, maybe the word would be irritating. Somebody might start asking, do you have permission to be in exactly this point,
right,
doing this precise thing?
Okay, well, keep talking on your phone there. Look, the country's supreme leader is the one who holds ultimate power, not the president. But what are Iranians telling you about how much this election matters to them?
Well, when Hassan Rouhani was first elected president in 2013, it was a big deal for the country. The previous president, Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, had in many ways further isolated Iran from the wider world, which is something that people clearly did not like and which they signaled that they did not like by electing Rouhani, who said that he would provide greater connections to the world and greater freedoms at home. And since that election, Rouhani made a nuclear deal with the United States and other world powers, which really has made a difference in Iran, not as much as many people wanted. And there's a lot of disappointment with Rouhani. The economy is not particularly improved, at least in ways that ordinary people can measure in their lives. But there is a degree of greater openness here, and there is a degree of economic activity that wasn't happening before, and a degree of connection with other places that wasn't there before.
So Rouhani is, you know, more the moderate, more reaching out. But what does Ebrahim Raisi represent? That's his challenger.
Well, it's really interesting, Robin. He's seen as far more conservative. He's someone who is very little known on the Iranian political scene until very recently. He was appointed to run a gigantic religious foundation that supports a very important shrine in the city of Mashhad. So it's a fairly powerful position, but obscure in terms of the public. But he is believed to be close to Iran's supreme leader and someone who represents a far more conservative point of view. Now, is there that much of a difference? Some people would disagree. We spoke with a newspaper editor of an English language publication called the Financial Tribune, which opened just in the last couple of years. His name is Khosrow Ghadiri. He's aware that people are very anxious about what this election could mean, but he's been telling people it's not that big a deal. It's just one guy who's part of a very, very complicated system. Let's listen.
They both think that if the other comes to the office, if the other comes to the power, then that will be a disaster. But I don't think so. It doesn't make much difference because you have the parliament, you have the Guardian Council. It doesn't depend only on one man named president.
He's referring to other power centers in Iran's government, which has a lot of checks and balances. He didn't even get around to mentioning the supreme leader, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, who's more powerful than any president. And it is true, a government is very complicated. It's hard to move it in a new direction. And look at the United States. Donald Trump came to office promising huge change and has found out that many of his promises have been very hard to keep as well. So it's a fair point that we don't know how much difference any one election will make. Although we do know that here in Iran, the last one did make a difference.
You remind us that candidate Donald Trump vilified the Iran nuclear deal. As president, he just extended it. NPR Steve Inskeep, there in Tehran, as Iranians go to the polls today to vote for a new president. Lucky you. Steve, thank you.
Always a pleasure to talk with you, Robin. Thanks.
Sweden's top prosecutor has dropped the rape investigation into WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange. And today, Assange addressed reporters from a balcony at the Ecuadorian embassy in London, where he has been living since 2012.
While today was an important victory and an important vindication, the road is far from over. The war, the proper war, is just commencing. The UK has said it will arrest me regardless.
That's because Assange still faces prosecution in the UK and possible extradition to the US, where Attorney General Jeff Sessions has said his arrest would be a priority for publishing thousands of highly sensitive documents. The BBC's Helena Lee joins us now. She's outside that embassy in London. And Helena, the 2010 rape charge came about during a trip that Assange had taken to Stockholm for a WikiLeaks conference. The accuser, of course, not happy about this. Why is Sweden dropping it?
You're right, she's not happy about it. The case has been dropped, and we heard earlier from the top prosecutor, Marianne Nye, in Sweden. What essentially she said was that his arrest warrant was being revoked as it was impossible to serve him notice. So basically, he's stuck in this embassy and they can't serve notice on him for him to go over to Sweden. So they have dropped the rape allegation case. I think it's crucial to say, though, for the moment, she did also go on to say that if in the future Julian Assange does decide to go to Sweden, then they could potentially reopen that investigation.
Well, Assange also has other charges against him. If he were to leave the embassy now, would the police in London arrest him?
Correct, he does. What he is wanted for here in London is back in June 2012, Julian Assange was on bail. He missed a court appearance in that year, so he didn't turn up to court. And so he's breached a court order, his bail conditions, basically. So what the Metropolitan Police in London has said is that if he does come out of the Ecuadorian embassy, as soon as he does, he will be arrested. So he has that threat still hanging over him.
Okay, and then in this country, of course, the question is, what happens then? Because we know Attorney General Jeff Sessions here is watching this very closely. Would Assange then be extradited to the United States?
Well, again, that's another concern of Julian Assange. What he'd had said in the past is that he was always willing to go to Sweden to face questions over this rape allegation. But his fear was that then America would extradite him and he would have to face charges there. And we know, as you say, the Department of Justice in America has said it wants to step up the investigation into him. What we don't know is whether an extradition request has been made yet. And the Home Office here in the UK doesn't comment at all on whether it receives extradition requests from other countries. So we don't know if that's the case. Perhaps there is one in at the moment. We just simply don't know.
Ultimately, Assange wants to go to Ecuador, right?
He does. I think probably the Ecuadorian embassy are pretty fed up of him being in there for nearly 5 years. They probably want him out and have said that he can go to Ecuador where he can continue his life there. And also America wants him on those potential charges. So everyone wants a solution to this issue, but it's difficult, I think, to see where this is going to lead. And I suspect what Julian Assange is doing here at the embassy right now is consulting his lawyer and going through what his options are. But if he does come out, as I said, he would be arrested by the police.
Well, you know, finally, before I let you go, this is just a case that the world has watched for many years now. As we've said, Julian Assange has lived inside the embassy since 2012. It's almost almost bizarre. What is life like for Julian Assange inside that embassy?
Well, I suspect, and I can only imagine, it's probably a very lonely life, a difficult life. He won't have seen much sunlight apart from when he appears out on the balcony. And obviously, what's distressing for him, and he mentioned this in a tweet earlier on, is that he's got two children and he hasn't seen them for many, many years. So that will be obviously clearly very upsetting for him. And I think that will be probably the one big issue that's upset him.
Well, certainly a lot of people probably don't have much sympathy for Julian Assange, including the woman who brought the rape charge against him in 2010. That's the BBC's Helena Lee joining us outside the Ecuadorian embassy in London. Helena, thank you very much.
Pleasure.
NBC's Saturday Night Live wraps up its 42nd season this weekend, and what a season it has been.
Back to James Comey. Your staff has been insisting all week that you didn't fire him because of his Russian investigation.
No, I did.
Wait, what?
I fired him because of Russia. I thought, he's investigating Russia. I don't like that. I should fire him.
Alec Baldwin's impersonation of Donald Trump have gotten under the president's skin. Trump has called the show a hit job, but late-night TV fans frankly have loved it. Joining us is NPR TV critic Eric Deggans. Hi, Eric.
Hi.
Hey, so ratings are way up, something like 20% this year. It's probably that Trump bump. How do you grade SNL this year?
Oh, well, I think they've done a great job. And it hasn't just been the fact that they've had a great Trump impression in Alec Baldwin. The writing's been really sharp, too.
Well, the media also loves to talk about Melissa McCarthy's portrayal of Sean Spicer. And here she was again last week. She was lurking in the bushes as Sean Spicer. And then she bursts into the press briefing room and takes the lectern from Sarah Huckabee Sanders.
Let's do this. First question, Michelin Man. Oh, I'm sorry. I meant Glenn.
Yes, some people are saying that based on President Trump's tweets that he is unhinged. Would you agree?
Oh, my God. Glenn, do I come to your job and slap the 7 or 8 hot dogs out of your mouth? You're really going to ask me that? This is offensive. If he's crazy, he's crazy like a fox with mental problems.
You know, first of all, poor Glenn Thrush at the New York Times, although I guess I'm sure he loves it. But look, there's been a lot of talk that, hey, Sean Spicer may not be around that much longer. Trump has talked about either moving him out of the public eye or firing him altogether. At least there's been inklings of that. What does SNL do without that Spicer punchline?
Well, first of all, we know that Trump loves making his subordinates feel unsure about their tenures. So he often makes people feel like they're on the verge of being fired. So I who knows if he's going to be gone. But I think they can regurgitate this Spicer character whenever they want. Now, he's played by Melissa McCarthy, who is not a regular cast member. That impression, I think, was kind of a surprise. When she first did it, no one knew it was coming. And certainly no one expected that a woman would be the person they would tap to play Sean Spicer. So it was really impressive. It also, though, shows that SNL's best impressions, I think, throughout this whole election season have been by people who are not regular cast members for the most part. Kate McKinnon has been great as Kellyanne Conway and as our Attorney General Jeff Sessions. But otherwise, it's been Larry David as Bernie Sanders. It's been Alec Baldwin as President Trump. And now Melissa McCarthy is Sean Spicer.
Well, there has been some criticism of SNL and late night in general that it's ridiculing conservatives and getting too much fun out of it, and that maybe that's adding to some of the resentment that Trump actually capitalized on to win. Do you think that's fair?
Well, I think, number one, they make fun of who's in power, and the Republicans are in power right now, and there is no denying that the chaos of the White House has captivated the nation. So to expect one of TV's leading outlets for satire to ignore that or not capitalize on that, I think, is unfair. Also, I have this theory that different kinds of media draw people of different political persuasions. So the late night satire field, the audience seems to be more liberal. So they're speaking to the interests of their audience, too.
One of the show's biggest stars, and this has nothing to do with politics, Bobby Moynihan, is leaving. We know him as Drunk Uncle, and here he is opining on Halloween.
People don't even trick or treat anymore, Colin. You know, when I was a kid, monsters were men. It was just Ghost, Goblin, Frankenstein, Lagoon Man, Communist Dracula. Hello. Nowadays, it's just trick or treat. Can you put some goji berries in my Dropbox, please?
Oh, man. Moynihan has been around for a long time, the second longest tenured actor currently on SNL, but he has a new show.
Yeah, he has a show on CBS called Me, Myself, and I, and it's really interesting. It's basically centered on this guy, and it shows his life in three iterations: when he was a kid, when he was a middle-aged adult, and when he is a senior citizen. In a future time, the middle-aged adult lives in modern times in 2017, and Moynihan plays the middle-aged guy. Moynihan is one of those utility player guys, you know, he's always in the right place at the right time. He hasn't had a lot of breakout characters that he's created. You know, we heard one of them. But there's this theory that once you're on the show for about four seasons, you've got enough capital in the comedy world that you can go off and do your own thing. So certainly he's earned his stripes and he's ready to go on to something else.
So predictions for SNL next season?
Well, I think what they have to do is focus on keeping the writing sharp. I think it's easy to get distracted by the fact that they have these great impressions, but what really made them work was great sketches. So what I'm hoping we'll see is that they will not get distracted or overuse these really great impressions that they've gotten from these really great performers.
Okay, NPR TV critic Eric Deggans, thanks as always.
Always a pleasure.
So as we've been mentioning today, President Trump is just embarking on his first trip abroad, and it's already being discussed online. So joining us for our Friday look at how the news is filtering through social media, Femi Okeh, host of The Stream on Al Jazeera English in Washington. Hi, Femi.
Hello there, Robin.
The president going to Saudi Arabia, but also Jerusalem, the Vatican, Brussels. What are people saying online?
Well, this is how the president sort of announced it to the Twitter world. He says, "Getting ready for my big foreign trip." Richard Al Williams responds. He's from The Independent. "Big foreign trip? You're the president of America, not Bill and Ted." There's a lot of concern about how serious President Trump is going to take this trip and how qualified he is. But let me start with a big block on Twitter. And this is a lot of the Muslim communities around the United States and around the world are concerned about what may be in President Trump's speech as he speaks to the Muslim world. I highly recommend you look at Wajahat Ali and also at RNS, that's Religion News Service. And you can see there Wajahat channeling what he thinks President Trump might say. In the satire are some very deep concerns. You can laugh and cry all at the same time. And this one from Scott Presler, who is a big Trump fan, and he says he is praying for a safe trip. And I think lots of people are doing that too, but for various different reasons.
Well, it's so interesting because this is a president who's, you know, suggested a ban on certain Muslims and, you know, talked about Saudi Arabia not paying its share and getting too much money from the U.S. So it'll be, you know, be interesting to see as he heads out there. But there's also been some reaction to the announcement that country music star Toby Keith is going to be performing at the same time in Saudi Arabia. He of the hits "I Love This Bar" and "Drunk Americans" is going to be performing
Whiskey Girl, right, made in America.
Right, in a no-alcohol country, Saudi Arabia. But it gets better. It's a men-only concert. What are people saying?
Starts at 9 p.m. if you can get there. I think you might have to fly there right now.
Well, I can't go.
It's in Riyadh and open only to men. Now, there are a lot of events around President Trump visiting Saudi Arabia. So some of these are entertainment events. Neil King, who is a female Neil King, says being banned from attending a Toby Keith concert is probably the one and only perk of being a woman in Saudi Arabia. And I'm going to say she is saying that from a Western perspective, because there will be lots of people from different parts of the world who will take issue with that. But she is making a joke about, it's okay, I don't want to go see Toby Keith anyway. But a beautiful flyer with Toby sitting next to the Arabian lute player called Rabbe Singh, and he is going to be playing as well tomorrow. So that would be very interesting.
So fascinating. Well, and it could, again, you know, people are, you know, a little nervous about missteps. Gabriella Paella tweeted, "Toby Keith is 100% going to bring up Saudi Arabia's involvement in 9/11, kicking off a massive international crisis." So
yikes.
We'll watch all this nervously. Something that the president said earlier this week is really prompting a lot of response.
One thing?
Yeah, well, this one is when he was addressing the graduates at the Coast Guard Academy in New London,
yes,
Connecticut. And he veered off to talk about himself. Let's listen.
"Look at the way I've been treated lately. Especially by the media. No politician in history, and I say this with great surety, has been treated worse or more unfairly." You can't.
Femi, what are people saying?
Well, you know, when you speak to a friend and you say something and your friend goes, actually, and they're just about to prove you totally wrong, the internet pretty much in unison went, actually, Sean Martian, for instance, says, a list here, 4 presidents assassinated, 2 shot, not killed, 1 accused of being born in Kenya. Jason Sweeney puts together the entire drama. Trump, no politician has been treated worse or more unfairly. Kennedy, you got this? Lincoln, sure. Hold my beer. So, I think you get where he's coming from. And somebody digging even deeper into history, Greg Jenner talks about Julius Caesar. He was stabbed 23 times by his friends and colleagues. And then also pictures of Nelson Mandela when he was imprisoned on Robben Island. So many more examples of politicians who've had very, very terrible, difficult times while they've been politicians.
Look, Massachusetts Congressman Seth Moulton, when President Trump also said this is the worst witch hunt in history, Seth Moulton, again from Massachusetts, tweeted out, well, I'm from Massachusetts, and I'm pretty sure there was a worse witch hunt here, you know, referring to the Salem witch hunt. Femi Okeh, host of the stream on Al Jazeera English. As always, thank you so much.
Always a pleasure.
And Femi mentioned, you know, Toby Keith is going to be performing with someone else in Saudi Arabia this week. And let's first listen to a little bit of what people are going to hear. Here's a little Toby Keith. And it's gonna be here when you hear Mother Freedom start ringing her bell. And then he'll be playing alongside Saudi singer and lute player Rabah Sager. Cannot wait to hear the reviews of this one. Toby Keith and Rabah Sager. You're listening to Hear It Now.
This podcast and the following message are sponsored by Blue Apron. Blue Apron partners with sustainable farms, fisheries, and ranchers to bring you everything you need to create incredible home-cooked meals. Ingredients come pre-measured, so there's no food waste, and it's delivered right to your door. Rediscover how fun cooking can be while enjoying seasonally inspired recipes and exploring new flavors and cuisines. No commitment. Get the meals only when you want. Get your first 3 Blue Apron meals free, plus free shipping, by visiting blueapron.com/here.
A valuable student loan benefit for government and nonprofit workers may be on the chopping block. The Public Service Loan Forgiveness Program, which wipes out the balance of a qualifying student's debt after 10 years, would end under a Trump administration budget proposal. Danielle Douglas-Gabriel is a reporter with The Washington Post. She's been following this. And Danielle, how does the program work?
Sure. So George W. Bush actually enacted this program back in 2007 to help people who are interested in public service work, whether that means doctors deployed in rural areas where they are needed the most, or lawyers deployed in legal aid or public defender's office. The problem is, or at least critics of this program say the problem is that it's very costly. A recent Government Accountability Office report, I think, pegged that the average person who would benefit from this program has roughly $100,000 worth of debt.
Does it also include people who want to work for the government or for nonprofits who may otherwise not be able to make very much money in a salary?
Yes. If you work for any governmental agency, whether federal or state, as well as any nonprofit, and that's kept it pretty broad. You know, people who are critical of this program say that it is a backdoor subsidy for people to get graduate degrees because the vast majority of people who would probably benefit from this have advanced degrees.
Huh. Well, what does it mean for all of these people? I mean, 500,000 is what your reporting is showing us.
So that's the least of it. That $500,000 actually represents the people who have submitted what are called certification forms, verifying that their income and that they're working at a nonprofit every year. But you don't have to submit those verification forms to be eligible. And it's entirely possible that upwards of 2 million to 3 million people may be eligible for this program, even if they haven't submitted those forms. And what this might mean for them is a bit uncertain because the first wave of folks who are supposed to qualify for this would happen in October. So 2007 to 2017, that's your 10 years. But we have no sense, and the White House isn't telling us whether the folks who are 5 years into their work in the public sector or 6 years into their work in the public sector would all of a sudden kind of have the rug pulled from underneath them and no longer qualify.
Well, it's just one part of a big plan at the Department of Education to cut its budget by, you know, nearly $11 billion. I'm noticing from your reporting there's 22 programs on the line, a $1.2 billion cut for after-school programs, which serves more than a million children, many of them poor. Has there been a lot of backlash to this?
From our reporting, definitely. I think myself and my colleagues who wrote the story, we received a lot of emails and a lot of calls from people who are very much outraged by this. Now, keep in mind, this is the most complete draft of the budget, so it is entirely possible that maybe the public outcry will have the White House walk back some of these proposals. But we certainly get a sense that a lot of low-income kids could possibly suffer. On the one hand, the administration has called for continued funding for Summer Pell, which is a program that primarily benefits low-income students. But on the other hand, they are cutting programs like campus childcare, which is meant for parents who are taking college classes. They're cutting college prep programs that are meant for high school seniors as well as college freshmen who are first generation. So if it stays the way that it is and Congress approves the budget as is, that it could be potentially very detrimental to a lot of people.
That's Danielle Douglas-Gabriel. She's a reporter for The Washington Post. Danielle, thanks very much.
Thank you.
As Asian American author Lisa Koh wrote in an op-ed piece in the New York Times, as a child, she was expected to love hamburgers and Sara Lee pound cakes and Swanson TV dinners because, as the first in her family to be born in America, it was a sign that she'd been assimilated and they'd arrived. But she eventually developed food allergies and realized that when her family gorged on Velveeta, they were trying to drown out guilt about those left behind and fear about economic uncertainties that lay ahead. And they were in the country legally. Now, in her debut novel, Lisa gives those anxieties to a young boy. He is born in America. His mother is an undocumented immigrant from China. The book is called The Leavers. It centers around the little boy, Deming Go, the son of Polly, who labors at a nail salon. They live in a crammed apartment in the Bronx with a makeshift family of other immigrants. There are cockroaches and two to a mattress, but they speak the same language and there is joy. Then, when Deming is 11, Polly goes to work one day and doesn't come back. Deming is left to look for answers.
Like a detective inspecting the same 5 seconds of surveillance video, he replayed last Wednesday afternoon, walking the blocks from school to home. Again and again, Deming and Mama crossed Fordham Road, waited at the light, slipped on the ice, hugged, Mrs. Johnson forever watching. He zoomed in on the frames, slow-motioned their walk up University, then reversed it, so they goose-stepped downhill, cars and buses groaning backwards. He picked apart the words she said, hunting for clues, the way his English teachers made them read poems and spend 20 minutes talking about a sentence, the meaning behind the meaning. The meaning behind her telling him about her life, the meaning of her not coming home.
Lisa Koh reading from The Leavers. So did Mom just walk out on him? She owed money. Was she killed? Was she deported? Deming is ultimately adopted by a well-meaning white couple who change his name to Daniel, move him to upstate New York, the only Asian there. The Leavers won the 2016 Penn Bellwether Prize for socially engaged fiction. Lisa Koh joins us in the studio. Congratulations. And we understand part of the inspiration for the book was your own life, growing up one of the few Asians in the town you lived in New Jersey.
A lot of the emotion does come from there, especially the chapters where Deming's transported from the big city to this small town, and he's suddenly super out of place in his new home.
Where was your family from?
We're ethnically Chinese, but my parents were born and raised in the Philippines, and I was born in New York and raised, as you said, in New Jersey.
You were born and raised here, mm-hmm. but still felt what when you were the only Asian or one of the only Asians in a white community? And what did you give to your character, Daniel?
In earlier drafts, his life was a little too bleak, and I really wanted to give him more joy. So I gave him a best friend. I gave him music. He's a musician, and he really falls in love with music. And that was something that I really related to and that partly came from my own experience. Growing up in this suburban town where I felt like I didn't belong, there was a way that I could use it to my advantage, and that in so many ways, that was why I became a writer and an artist. So claiming music for myself and sort of falling in love with that was a way to create an identity outside of these other identities.
Yeah, but you also have these sort of wince-inducing, well-meaning white parents who, first of all, change his name from his birth name that he'd had for 10 years.
They just want him to fit in.
Want him to fit in. He has that moment that you pray a child has where he finds his father's old Jimi Hendrix records, loves them, and yet everyone says, oh, no, 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 you have to be a good student and be responsible. And, you know, that they take it away.
Yeah. I mean, they don't want him to be Jimi Hendrix. They just want him to listen to Jimi Hendrix.
Well, do they want him to be a model minority, which he's not?
Yeah. And, you know, I think one of the things I wanted to explore in the book was this question of what does it mean to be a fit parent? A lot of the news stories that I was inspired by had U.S. courts saying adoptive American families have the resources to be better parents. So to me, I was really interested in that question. And his adoptive parents have social and economic capital, and they're really kind of, as professors, pressuring him to be like them, you know, and to reassure them that their choices are the right ones.
Well, when you say in the accounts that you were reading, that's the other inspiration you had. You read news stories, including one about the detention of an undocumented immigrant who lost her child to the foster system.
Yeah, and there are actually many cases of this that I read about. Parents have been deported or detained, and they're not allowed to take their kids with them, even if they want to.
Because the kids were born here.
Because the kids were born here, but, you know, it's really heartbreaking. And it also brings up a lot of questions about identity and family, because the U.S. government is saying these kids belong in the U.S. with adoptive parents who are mainly white and middle class, not with their birth parents.
Right. I think this book is uniquely a story about Asian immigrants. It's uniquely that on one level. But I was thinking you could read this through other prisons. You know, anyone who's taken out of a poverty situation, taken away from a parent, and is suddenly in a home the way Deming Daniel is his name when he gets his name gets changed. And he's looking, there's more rooms in his home in upstate New York than in his entire tenement.
Right.
He marvels that his adoptive mother just swipes a credit card and gets him something. Like, what's that? There's sort of anger about it.
Yeah.
You know, discovering inequity.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's interesting because it's not a really large geographical migration, like from China to New York. It's from a city in New York to a small town in New York, but it's still a really big distance psychologically for him.
Yeah. This is one of the first Asian characters we've read in a long time that he's not good at school.
Yeah.
You know, he's not good at his studies. But what's happening inside him? What's going on?
Well, you know, he's a young boy who's lost everything he's known. His mother has disappeared. He doesn't know why. He struggles with these issues of abandonment and loss. He's really going through a lot of trauma and mourning. And he's not given the tools in his new family to really process this.
He's not allowed to hold on to his identity.
No, he's not. Yeah, nobody really understands, right? So that's kind of behind his status as a student.
Well, you just look at food. They make him drink milk because they think it's good for him. It makes him sick.
Right.
And you have him go back to visit this childhood friend that he grew up with in this crammed apartment building. And he just chows down on tofu, beef, mushroom casserole, greens with garlic, crispy pork, whole steamed fish.
Oh, I'm getting hungry. I think there's a way that smelling food that he hasn't smelled for a long time kind of is just this shortcut way of bringing him back to his childhood. You know, there's a way that smell is the most powerful way to access nostalgia and memory. And suddenly having access to that when he visits is just this amazing kind of emotional way of reconnecting to that.
Yeah. He becomes something of a screw up, not unlike a lot of 20-somethings, but we know it's because he's so unmoored.
Yeah.
We're not going to give away the ending, but it's heartbreaking when you see how disrupted lives are when, let's just say, we remind you again, she was undocumented and this country has policies. Are you trying to say something about those policies or is it just about here's what happens when your identity gets wrenched and you don't know who you are?
I think what compelled me in the first place to write about this was just how shocked and horrified I was at learning about a lot of these policies and the effects they had on families. The questions that these stories raised regarding family and identity and culture and assimilation were ultimately the most interesting and what kind of drove it.
Yeah. It also seems like a book that should be written about adopting parents, about any child that comes from a culture that maybe is different from your own. Maybe honor that culture. Don't try to erase it.
Right. Yeah. And to me, it's really interesting about the idea even of culture, because it's definitely not something that's static. I think a lot of the ways that we talk about immigration and culture in the U.S. kind of has this idea of like one static culture meeting another static culture. And in reality, you know, assimilation is a lot more complicated than that. And I'm interested in the reasons why we're asked to assimilate and into what and why.
Yeah. By the way, we just a note for all writers out there, you weren't getting anything going, no traction. And so you set yourself a goal of 50 rejections a year.
Yeah, I ended up a few years ago trying to aim for rejections rather than acceptances when I sent out my work. It just felt a little easier for me, a kind of glasses half empty type person.
Well, yeah. Well, I got a rejection. Whoa, I'm moving towards 50.
So you're celebrating it instead of feeling really distraught, even though you kind of feel distraught. But yeah, I sent out this manuscript on a whim to the Penn Bellwether Prize, which is funded and established by Barbara Kingsolver. Totally forgot about it. And then 6 months later, I got a phone call from Barbara telling me I'd won.
And you went, oh, darn, I was looking for that 49th rejection.
Now I'll never reach that goal now. I'll turn it down.
Lisa Koh, her debut novel is The Leavers. Lisa, thank you.
Thank you so much for having me.
The death of grunge rocker Chris Cornell this week brought the issue of suicide to center stage once again. For years, health workers, researchers, and advocacy groups have been trying to lower the national suicide rate. But between 1999 and 2014, it actually rose 24%. And the key to prevention is still largely a mystery. Reporter Joanne Silberner found one reason for that may be the unpredictability of suicide. And a warning, this story may be disturbing to some listeners.
There may be no better way to learn about the hours and minutes before suicide than by talking to someone like Desiree Stage, someone who survived an attempt.
I was in an emotionally and physically abusive relationship. I wasn't really eating. I wasn't really sleeping. I wasn't good.
She was a college student studying psychology. She says she just couldn't see a future for herself.
And I would listen to the trains pass behind my house, and I was really thinking about, God, I would love to lay down on those train tracks and just wait.
She had spent months studying various methods. One afternoon, Stage's partner stormed out after a bitter argument. Stage can't say why then, at that moment, she decided to proceed. She grabbed some nearby substances. She doesn't want to say what.
I wanted to go, and I wanted to be done. I just wanted to be gone.
She was woozy and still hoping to die when paramedics burst in. Her partner had alerted them, and they got her to the hospital in time. Every suicide attempt is unique, says Julie Serrell, a psychologist and professor at the University of Kentucky and head of a suicide prevention group, the American Association of Suicidology. Serrell points to an Austrian study published 5 years ago of people who'd attempted suicide. Nearly half tried within 10 minutes of the initial decision. Others took hours, days, even months.
For other people, it's something that there's a stressor and they have available means and they end up making an attempt that sometimes is fatal.
Paul Currington says for him, it was exhaustion. He was living in Olympia, Washington, working for the state government.
I just kept sinking lower and lower as the years went on until one day in 2012 when that well of inner strength ran out.
He and his girlfriend had recently broken up, but he was hoping to get back together. He went out to a cafe to hear some music, and there she was, a few feet away, with her new boyfriend.
I ran out of the coffee shop. And that was the night I tried to kill myself.
He fled home and collapsed on the floor of his living room.
I don't think I could even hear anything. There was just this sound in my head, this roaring. And I was there for hours, just rocking back and forth.
He had a sharp object in his hand.
And I knew I shouldn't be doing this, but I knew I couldn't take that pain anymore.
The feeling was like falling off a cliff.
And finally, the fear and the anxiety of falling is so great, you start praying to hit the bottom of that cliff because it's better than falling forever.
Currington called a crisis line, and the volunteer counselor kept him talking for what felt like hours. In several recent studies, about 80% of callers said helplines stopped them from suicide. But Desiree Stage says she wouldn't have called.
It just didn't enter my mind. I didn't want help. I wanted to go.
And that's the challenge of stopping imminent suicides, says psychologist Julie Serrell. There's not a single intervention or a single marker.
Definitely not. There's a huge range of variability in how long people are suicidal, how much planning goes into their suicide attempts or suicide deaths, and kind of how much they anticipate that they're going to die.
She does say, based on research and her own clinical experience, talking to people directly won't push them over the edge.
If the idea is already there, actually asking people and working with them to figure out how to get help has been shown to really make people feel relieved and to help save lives.
There are steps that have been shown to reduce the chance that people will try to kill themselves. Treatment for depression, for example. Making sure guns aren't available to people with suicidal intent. Smaller packaging for painkillers. As for Desiree's stage, what would have stopped you?
I have no idea.
After a pause, she says, maybe if someone she trusted had walked in. Paul Currington knows what would not have helped. An appeal to reason. Someone saying you'll devastate your family or friends.
You're in too much pain to think about anyone else. You can't.
In a recent survey in the journal Depression and Anxiety, 54% of emergency room doctors and nurses said only some or a few suicides could be prevented. But some researchers are looking for concrete biomarkers like stress hormones or brain scans that might reveal structural or chemical changes. For the moment, the bottom line in the suicide prevention community is that because suicides are so variable, many different programs are needed to bring the numbers down. Hotlines, psychiatric treatment, what's called means restriction, public information campaigns, and more research. For Here and Now, I'm Joanne Silberner.